Hello and welcome to another episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. This is your host, Willem van der Horst. For anybody who hasn't listened to the show before, I'm a marketing and brand strategist and budding podcaster, I guess. But in terms of the day-to-day job, in short, I help brands, companies figure out how best to communicate with their audiences. And in the show, I have in-depth interviews, conversations with professionals in a wide variety of fields, most often around marketing, advertising, media, game design as well, because I'm really into gaming, tabletop gaming, role-playing games, and looking at the connection between those things. And in terms of marketing and advertising, having conversations with people who have different perspectives, either a different part of the world or they have left the industry and they're doing something very different. But my favorite topics to learn about, honestly, I'm still figuring out the editorial line of this thing little by little. And it's just a fascinating journey. I'm really having so much fun and learning so much from all the different people I'm interviewing and the post-game analysis, like publishing every week, organizing the interviews, learning little by little how to do a better interview. And this was an interesting one today because I was quite nervous, so I'll come back to it. But don't forget, for every episode, wherever you're listening to this, most people do listen through iTunes. You might be listening through it on my website. A few people use Stitcher. I use Stitcher, actually. I really like Stitcher as well. Or whatever your favorite podcast listening app is. If you enjoy this episode, please take a moment to post a rating or a review wherever you're listening. iTunes would be amazing. Even if you don't listen via iTunes, if you have iTunes, open iTunes, type in Ice Cream for Everyone podcast, look it up, post a rating and review. It really helps more people find the show. I'm doing this out of my bedroom, essentially, with a cheap microphone, little by little. I hope to get some more material as I go, but it really helps more people find the show, and I just want more people to listen to it, essentially. And beyond that, you can find out and check out more content on my main website. That's at www.icecreamforeveryone.net. Everything attached, spelled out, icecreamforeveryone.net. On there, one of the main other things you can find is my weekly long-form newsletter, Ice Cream Sunday. Guess when that's released? I don't know how many times I'm going to make that joke. Forever, essentially, because it is published every Sunday. You can sign up, and you sign up, you receive it first by email, or you can also get it on my blog, medium.com, LinkedIn, Pulse. That's with a week's delay. And I'd say watch out for the latest newsletter. It took me really a while to write. I've been working on it and for a while with the support of several friends. It's a really very personal kind of tough story from a while back I had in Paris where I was on TV that special time. Special in an extremely weird way, but yeah, watch out for that one. Check it out. Those already signed up to the newsletter, you already seen it, maybe read it, maybe. If not, it's going to be online very soon. You'll be able to read it. On to our guests. More information about our guest today. Really, really honored and quite nervous having this conversation with Cindy Gallup. Cindy was really nice enough to make some time for a conversation for the podcast. It was lovely to talk to her. For those who don't know, Cindy was pretty well known in the advertising and marketing industry. She's had a long career working in different continents, in London, for Europe, in Singapore. She set up the Singapore office for this agency called BBH. It's one of the best advertising agencies around. And since she left that, she speaks about on a regular basis. She consults with different brands and companies. She talks about innovation, diversity in business and in advertising in particular, feminism, of course, sorry, and sex as well. She talks a lot about sex, and we're going to be talking about sex during the episode. She spoke at TED, the famous conference, Technology, Entertainment, Design. Well, that's how it started, but otherwise you can find all the talks on TED.com and all the links are going to be in the show notes. You can check out all the links of what I'm talking about, right? And she launched her business called Make Love, Not Porn. And we talk about that as well as the sex tech industry and sex tech initiatives. It's not that easy. It doesn't roll off the tongue, sex tech, does it? During the episode. And as I said, I was kind of nervous, but I think we had a great conversation overall. There's one thing I really have to apologize for, and it really sucks. It's the second time in a row I have to apologize for that. I've been having some internet connection issues with my new house in London. I've been sorting them out. I'm changing the internet provider and it's going to be back next week. But it makes it that the Skype conversations broke down. So there's like a couple of minutes, 1 minute more or less, where the connection's not great. We can still understand what Cindy's saying, but I'm really, really sorry. I'm just doing my best to get everything together. I'm changing my ISP, upgrading the internet so that I don't have that kind of issues again. And in the meanwhile, I've been recording interviews face-to-face or at other people's places. Anyway, but apologies again for the problems. Bear with me. I don't think it makes... the whole thing is still intelligible. It still should work. Also, please note there's a little bit of swearing in this episode. And of course, we're talking about sex. So if ever you're not comfortable with that, that's fair warning. You might not want to listen to the whole episode. Aside from that, last thing... Cindy at the end talks about the different events she's going to be speaking at. I thought I'd mention at the beginning, she's going to be speaking in Sydney, Australia. So if you're on the other side of the world in Sydney, Australia, listening to this, she's going to be the keynote speaker opening the Mumbrella 360 conference in Sydney on the 7th of June. And then a few months later in August, she's definitely going to be in San Francisco talking at a user experience conference. But she's also on Twitter at Cindy Gallup and her website and a bunch of other places where she's updating everything she's where she's present, the different events she's speaking at, etc. So anyway, without further ado, here's Cindy Gallup. Good morning, Cindy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, and I'm delighted to be here.
Well, it's really nice. Thank you very much for taking time. I enormously appreciate it. It's quite an honor to be talking to you. I'm excited.
Thank you.
I've been reading like a lot of different stuff for preparation and trying to figure out a way to have a conversation that would be both interesting and maybe slightly different from usual, or at least not as linear. This is where I thought I'd start, which is kind of a little bit at the beginning. And I was reading your Wikipedia entry, and I saw that your mother's from Malaysia, right?
Yes, that's right. She's Malaysian Chinese.
Malaysian Chinese. And you have family, she or some family lives in Penang?
Yep. My mother is one of, my mother has nine brothers and sisters. So okay. there's a lot of the Asian side of my family scattered around Asia, actually.
Yeah. And so I've spent some time in Malaysia. I really like it. I would have loved to spend more time in Penang, but I mean, Malaysia is really known for its food and Malaysians love their food. And Penang is even more known for a lot of different specialties.
Absolutely, yes.
I thought I'd ask you if you have a favorite Penang dish.
My favorite Penang dish is Penang laksa.
Ah, fantastic. That's my favorite as well. For anybody who doesn't know, can you describe what it is for anybody who doesn't know?
Sure. So laksa is, it's not unique to, Malaysia. Laksa is very big in Singapore as well, and you can get it elsewhere in Asia. But, there are two types of laksa. The Singaporean laksa is, made with coconut milk. But the Penang laksa is, it's a kind of noodle dish with a in a kind of spicy soup sauce, and it's made with noodles and fish and herbs, and it's just utterly, utterly delicious.
Yeah, and you've got the tamarind side of things in the Assam laksa as well, which gives it this kind of sourness along with the heat.
But Penang laksa is pretty spicy, which is lovely.
I really love that as well. Absolutely. And I've noticed in a few of your talks that you have like some brilliant movie references and analogies usually, and following the food thread, but getting close to some of the topics that you regularly talk about. I imagine you've seen Tampopo?
I haven't actually. I know of it, but I've never actually watched it.
Oh, really? Okay.
But yes, I know the infamous scene in Tampopo.
which one do you think is the infamous scene? Because it's like...
There's obviously a lot of very sensuous activity going on.
Yes, particularly with that couple, and so which you probably have heard about because I would imagine that those ones come from there. So you have this kind of gangsterish guy and a couple, and there's a few interspersed scenes with them. One of them with an egg yolk, which is another one with a shrimp, and she's like he's tickling her with a live shrimp, and they're laughing while they're in bed. And another one with an oyster. So there's a lot of sensual sexual references in the movie. So I was wondering if you'd seen it. Oh, well, I would definitely recommend it. I'd love to hear what you think some other time.
Sure.
But, well, no, then not that one. But I was wondering, because that was leading us to something Japanese, and you gave a talk to the 3% conference, which we can talk about what that is as well. And there was a story that you talked about, which I thought was quite, well, it was really good and quite epitomized a lot of the what's going on in the advertising industry, that you had a conversation with a couple of creative directors from an advertising agency in Japan last year.
That's right, yep.
Yeah, I thought I was wondering if you could tell the story and how that came about. Sure. And what happened.
Sure. So, I've done quite a bit of work with Japan over my advertising career. Very early on in the late 80s, when I was at GGT, I worked on the Toshiba corporate business, which required me to go to Japan. When I was working for BBH Asia Pacific in Singapore, I ran our Levi's Asia Pacific business, and we were also the agency for Levi's Japan. And so I commuted from Singapore to Tokyo a lot.
Yeah.
And then when I left BBH to work for myself, I worked for several years on retainer as a consultant to the Japanese ad agency Hakuhodo.
Yeah.
And I'm a huge fan of Hakuhodo. I have many friends there, and I find them very impressive as an agency in all sorts of ways. So I was in I was in Tokyo last year to speak at the iMedia Summit Tokyo, and I met up with some friends from Hakuhodo for lunch, and two Hakuhodo creative directors came along to lunch as well, because it had been announced that I would be the president of the Glass Lion jury at Cannes, and they were very keen to come and hear what the Glass Lion was all about. So we had this very nice lunch in Tokyo. And one of the two creative directors was an older male creative director at Hakuhodo. And so, you know, I was explaining that the criteria for entries to the Glass Lion, which, you know, as an award, it celebrates. I'm sorry, what was that?
No, I was just going to ask you to make sure to explain what the Glass Lions was, which you were just about to do. So,
So the Glass Lion awards and celebrates advertising that shatters gender stereotypes. It was actually Sheryl Sandberg's idea. She proposed it to Cannes, and I was enormously honored to be the inaugural jury president last year. So I was talking about this, and I was saying, you know, from my perspective, the very important thing to understand was that, you know, advertising that shatters gender stereotypes is not, you know, advertising about wildly empowered women being wildly empowered. It's simply about advertising that reflects the world around us as it really is, which is not something that our industry is generally good at doing. So, you know, the gentleman from Hakuhodo, and apologies because I have, unfortunately, I'm mentally blanking on his name. But he said, oh, you know, that's really good to hear, because I don't think women always want to be empowered. Now, this is the kind of statement at which my hackles start rising.
Yes.
But I said, oh, you know, what do you mean? I think his name was, I think it was Mori-san. Uh-huh. And he said, well, you know, my mother, you know, she was a Japanese housewife, like many Japanese women are, and she was just very happy staying home, raising us, you know, she never worked, and, you know, she was perfectly happy doing all of that. So I said, how old is your mother? And he said, she's 86. And I said, when we're that age, we have to tell ourselves stories that make us feel good about how our lives played out. I said, at 86, your mother is not going to look back on her life and go, oh my God, I wasted it. But for all you know, she was silently screaming inside all those years that she was staying home and doing nothing but cooking and housework and raising you guys. And you know, I said to him, it's really important to be aware of the role that our industry plays in perpetuating stereotypes through popular culture that then have an actual impact on society.
Yeah.
And, you know, I talked about the fact that I'm continually working to combat this. I'm one of the Advertising Council here in New York, one of the campaign review committee chairs. And, you know, if anybody at that council who sits in my reviews will tell you, I am the person who, at the end of a review, will say to the agency presenting work, you know, in addition to those script revisions that we talked about, please, can you do one more thing? Can you flip the genders? Can you put the boy in the kitchen with mum, and can you put the girl on the soccer field with dad? And, you know, I talked also about how, you know, one of the things I constantly exhort our industry to do is to, you know, move on from the stereotype of the typical heterosexual relationship role model. And by the way, this reinforces stereotypes in any relationship role model. You know, the man is the strong, confident breadwinner and the woman is the warm, nurturing carer.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I would like to see our industry reflect in advertising today the real aspirational relationship role model, which is the way relationships work today, which is a partnership of equals.
Yeah.
Because today, both halves of a partnership work because they have to, because the economy in every country demands that there are two incomes. And that requires a renegotiation of, you know, who does the childcare, who does the housework. It requires a renegotiation of how you feel when the wife earns more than the husband. So I was explaining all this to Mori-san, and he listened. And I was enormously impressed with his response, because he said to me, he said, you're absolutely right. He said, I have a four-year-old daughter, and, you know, I do not operate with her in any gendered way. You know, I take her to karate. We will kick a ball around together. I will braid her hair when she wants me to. And he said, and then I go into my office and I write the exact stereotyped advertising you're talking about.
Yeah.
He said, I'm so glad we had this conversation, because I'm going to go back into the office this afternoon. I'm going to start writing different advertising. Yeah. And by the way, Willem, I was very impressed that a senior male Japanese creative director was actually taking this on board and saying that to me. And I was also very entertained, because he also said, and it's a really good thing we're having this conversation at lunchtime. Because, he said, and obviously I know this, he said, you know, in Japan, you know, we are out every night at yep. business dinners. And, you know, what you do is you talk about business and you get very, very drunk and you stagger home drunk. You wake up with a hangover and you've forgotten everything you talked about. He said, I'm really glad we had this conversation sober at lunchtime, because now I can put it into practice.
Yes.
And you know, that was just so enormously encouraging. And in fact, I said to him, please do, because when you do this for your brand, you will make a shit ton of money.
Yeah.
You know, I said the first Japanese brand that you create this different kind of advertising for, you know, first of all, Japanese housewives and working women, Japanese women everywhere will embrace the empathy and the understanding this demonstrates. And secondly, you'll make a shit ton of money, because you will elevate yourself above the competition, because no other Japanese brand is talking to women, the primary purchasers of everything, yeah. in this way.
Absolutely. Did you hear any either actions or feedback either after you talked about it with other people or with that creative director himself?
No, I haven't had the chance to circle back with my friends in Tokyo, so I don't know.
Okay. But it certainly is an absolute impact that I absolutely agree with. It's, and it's something that you've talked about a bunch of times as well. And that I'm making effort to talk to different people as well. It's just to avoid the homogenous, like, you know, the same people talking to the same people. And like a Tampopo reference, it won't spoil the movie, but there's a fantastic scene. There's two scenes actually that are related to that. One is a group of older businessmen, so Japanese, very traditional businessmen in a very fancy French restaurant, and they don't understand what they're looking at in the menu. And so the first person just orders the sole, and then, you know, every single person proceeds to repeat the same thing because they just don't really know, until they get to the last guy. So it's not really about gender, but it's just about somebody challenges the status quo and he's being kicked by his boss under the table because he's asking questions about the menu, which I thought was kind of interesting. And but absolutely fun. And it's really encouraging to hear that there's actions being taken and hoped for, you know, some change in terms of gender stereotypes. And I think it's an answer. It's not just gender stereotypes. It's an answer to changing a lot of status quo and opening new opportunities altogether for branding and advertising.
Exactly.
So if we circle back a little bit, I was reading, you know, a little bit where you're from and that you studied in Oxford and that you started your career in theater. So I was wondering if you acted in your like either teenage years or youth or?
At school and at university, yeah. But I adored acting, but I'm not a very good actor. So not beyond those purely amateur contexts.
Did you have a favorite play or style or playwright?
Not particularly, no.
No? Okay. All right. And so how did you move from like working in theater to working for an advertising agency?
Well, I read English at Oxford and fell madly in love with theatre there because yeah. Oxford has a very thriving student drama scene. And so, you know, I went, oh my God, I just want to work in theatre for the rest of my life. Mm. And I did everything in Oxford. I acted, directed, stage managed, wrote. But I used to draw a lot when I was younger. And so at Oxford, you know, friends began asking me to design theatre posters for them.
Okay.
And then from there, I kind of got sucked into promoting friends' shows and marketing them to pull in audiences. And I really enjoyed doing that. So I knew I wasn't good enough to be an actress or a director. And so I became a theatre marketing and publicity officer for a couple of theatres in the UK. And I did that for several years until I got completely fed up with earning nothing and working, you know, 24/7.
Right.
And the point at which I was beginning to feel like this was I was the marketing officer for the Everyman Theatre in Liverpool.
Mm-hmm.
And part of my job promoting the theatre was to give talks about it to groups of people. So I gave a talk to a group of women. And after the talk, one of them came up to me and she said, young lady, you could sell a fridge to an Eskimo.
Hmm.
And I thought, okay, that is the universe telling me something. It's time to sell out the establishment and go into advertising. So I did.
Right. So that was the beginning of your career in advertising. Obviously, there's a long career, 30 years or something in total, building brands, working in advertising. Was there a particular highlight, let's say a proudest moment in your career in advertising that you can tell us about?
I guess it was very nice in 2003 to be voted Advertising Woman of New York's Advertising Woman of the Year. So that was a nice highlight. But generally speaking, I mean, as you say, it's been a very long and very rich and rewarding career. So I can't pull out any specific moments.
Okay. That's fine. So there's in a few of your talks where you talk about the status of advertising and of business at the moment, and you're talking about how, advertising agencies and the process we go through and a lot of businesses are part of an old order, and that, you know, there's time right now to build something new, because if we try to keep changing the old order, it's just giving the same thing over and over again, right? And I was wondering out of that, well, I mean, maybe you can give us a bit of a background on that side of that idea, but I was wondering, also out of that, there's a lot of large influences in business and in tech these days, like Google, Facebook. And I was wondering if you think these are part of a new order or they're part of the same old guard and the same old stuff in a different garb, I guess, perhaps.
Well, I guess the interesting thing, and by the way, anyone who's interested, I would refer them to my talk on redesigning the business of advertising.
Yes.
And if you call my name and that, then you can find it very easily.
And I'll add that in the show notes, because I realize... For anybody listening, I'm referring to a few of the things you've said before, so you can, you know, I'll add the links to the different talks that I'm referring to.
But you know, I guess, I mean, the interesting thing is, I mean, first of all, everything new gets old very quickly, and
yeah.
So, you know, as new ventures and innovation, you know, scale and grow and mature, it's surprising how often they default to old world order ways of thinking and doing things. And so, you know, I talk a lot about the future of advertising and how to reinvent our industry, which it's so appallingly bad at doing, because I also observe that, you know, even, you know, new world order companies like Google and Facebook default very quickly to the old world order view of advertising. Facebook has extraordinary resources, amazing talent, and yet, you know, its advertising model is fundamentally an amplification of display ads.
Yeah.
And there are so many more interesting things that that they could be doing. And by the way, those interesting things are things that I would love our industry to set the agenda for and to lead on. But in the absence of our industry doing that, I would like to see the big digital players being much more creative and inventive in the way that they approach it. And so really what that demonstrates is that, you know, I operate at the interface of creativity and technology, and that interface has not even begun to be leveraged in the way that it could.
Yeah.
And the problem is that, you know, on the creativity side, which is how I reference our industry broadly, there's a, oh my God, they're the geeks and the nerds, we don't understand what they're doing. And on the technology side, they are the arty-farty, old world order creative types walking around with their head in the clouds, and we are the future, and never the twain shall meet. Mm. And so I don't see those two things coming together really productively to really completely reinvent the whole concept of what is advertising. And that's something I would like to see and help make happen.
Yeah. Do you have any kind of examples of new platforms or new ways to advertise or brand that could be an interesting example of something that could be used these days, or that comes to mind, or that a brand has done recently? Or
So first of all, I talk about the kinds of things that future advertising could be about in my talk.
Okay,
and cool. So I recommend that people go to that. Yeah. Rather than give the talk all over again here.
That's fine.
And secondly, I, whenever I talk about the future advertising, I always get asked the same two questions from the audience at the end of the talk.
Yeah.
But the first question is, Susie, who is doing everything you're talking about?
Mm.
And my answer is nobody. Mm. And by the way, I wish that wasn't the answer, because I am desperate to showcase case studies of people who really are inventing the future advertising, but I can't.
Yeah.
And the second question is, so what will make people do the things you're talking about? And I go, only one thing, total, utter, complete fucking disaster. Mm. That's what it takes to get our industry to reinvent itself. And as I said earlier, it is spectacularly failing too currently.
Yeah. And talking about the Silicon Valley, because we were in the middle of that, I'm wondering, well, I kind of have an idea, but you have perhaps some comments. You know, the Silicon Valley is also known for like being massively male, white dominated, right? I wonder how much correlation there is between that and just adopting an old world view of business.
Oh, every correlation. I mean, that's what I talk about all the time across every industry.
I guess that's kind of what I was
saying. Diversity drives innovation.
Yes. So there's a couple of big, big projects that you talk about a lot, and particularly Make Love Not Porn, which is the big project that you launched it with your TED Talk in 2009.
It's not a project, it's a business.
Business, sorry. Apologize. Can you tell us a little bit about that for anybody who doesn't know?
Sure. So Make Love Not Porn is an accident. I never consciously, intentionally set out to do anything that I and my team find ourselves doing now. It derives from direct personal experience. So I date younger men who tend to men in their 20s. And about 9 or 10 years ago, before the media ever picked up on any of this, I began realizing through dating younger men that I was encountering an issue that would quite honestly never have crossed my mind if I'd not encountered it so very intimately and personally. Mm-hmm. I realized I was encountering what happens when two things converge. And I stress the dual nature of this convergence because most people think it's only one. I realized I was encountering what happens when today's total freedom of access to hardcore porn online meets our society's equally total reluctance to talk openly and honestly about sex. Yep. It's a convergence of both of those factors that results in porn becoming, by default, the sex education today in not a good way. So I found myself encountering a number of sexual behavioral memes. I went, whoa, I know where that behavior is coming from. And I thought, gosh, if I'm experiencing this, other people must be as well. And being very action-oriented, I decided to do something about it. Mm. So 8 years ago, I put up on No Money this tiny, clunky little website at makelovenotporn.com that posts the myths of hardcore porn and balances them with reality. So the construct is porn world versus real world.
Yeah.
I had the opportunity to launch Make Love Not Porn at TED, which I've been going to for a number of years. I took a deliberate decision to be very explicit in my TED talk because I knew that audience would not get this issue unless I was very straightforward about it.
Hmm.
As a result, I am to this day the only TED speaker to have uttered the words come on my face on the TED stage.
Yes.
6 times in succession. the talk went viral as a result, and it drove an extraordinary response to my tiny, clunky website that I had never anticipated. And you know, the response was so extraordinary from every country in the world that I saw an opportunity to do something that I believe in very strongly, which is that the future of business is doing good and making money simultaneously. I saw the opportunity for a big business solution to a huge untapped global social need. So what I decided to do was I always emphasize to people that Make Love Not Porn is not anti-porn because the issue isn't porn.
Yeah.
The issue is the total absence in our society of an open, healthy, honest conversation around sex in the real world, which if we had it would, amongst many other benefits, also mean people would then bring a real world mindset to the viewing of what is simply artificial entertainment. Our tagline is pro-sex, pro-porn, pro-knowing the difference.
Yeah.
Our mission is purely and simply to help make it easier for people to talk about sex. Talk about sex openly and honestly in the public domain, and talk about sex openly and honestly privately in your intimate relationships. So what I decided to do, therefore, was to take every dynamic that exists out there in social media currently mm-hmm. and apply them to the one area no other social network or platform is ever going to go in order to socialize sex and to make real-world sex and a discussion around it socially acceptable and therefore ultimately just as socially shareable as anything else we currently share on Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, Instagram. So a little over 3 years ago, my team and I launched the first stage of this vision, which is MakeLoveNotPorn.tv. Mm-hmm. MakeLoveNotPorn.tv is an entirely user-generated, crowdsourced video sharing platform that celebrates real-world sex. So it's the dot-com site brought to life. I'm a great believer in communication through demonstration.
Yep.
Anybody from anywhere in the world can submit videos of themselves having real-world sex. And we're very clear what we mean by this. We're not porn. We're not amateur. We're building a whole new category on the internet that does not currently exist, social sex.
Yeah.
Our competition isn't porn. It's Facebook and YouTube, or it would be if Facebook and YouTube allowed sexual self-expression and self-identification, which they don't.
Yeah.
So real-world sex videos of Make Love Not Porn are not about performing for the camera. They're about doing what you do on every other social platform, which is simply capturing what goes on in the real world as it happens in all its funny, messy, ridiculously wonderful, beautiful humanness. We curate to make sure it's real. We don't publish anything unless it is.
Yep.
And we have a revenue-sharing business model. So part of the sharing economy, just like Uber and Airbnb, you pay to rent and stream real-world sex videos, and then 50% of that income goes to our contributors, or as we like to call them, our Make Love Not Porn stars. Mm. Because we would like our Make Love Not Porn stars one day to be as famous and celebrated as YouTube stars, for the same reasons, their authenticity, their realness, their individuality, and we would like them to make just as much money. We want to hit the kind of critical mass where one day, your real-world sex video, Make Love Not Porn, could hit 1 million rentals at $5 per rental, and we give you half of that revenue.
Yeah. And you've talked a few times, and you kind of hinted at that right now, and talking about the big companies that don't accept adult content. You've talked a few times about the challenges to finance this kind of project that doesn't really, for which there's no space, and the financial space is either like banks don't want to work with you, and how do you do the revenue sharing? I thought that was fascinating when you said that the challenges you're facing are intrinsically linked to the future of money as well.
So one thing that I did not realize when I embarked on this venture was the team and I would fight a battle every single day on it. Essentially, because every single piece of business infrastructure any other startup can at least take for granted, we can't, because the small print always says no adult content. So we can't get funded. We can't get banked. You know, people won't work with us. Every single tech service, in its terms of service, said it won't work with us. You have to reach out to the founders or the head of the company to beg them to work with us. And I'm very public about all of this because I'm fighting this battle on behalf of all of us who want to change the world through sex. Because the answer to everything that worries people about porn and sex is not to shut down, censor, clamp down, block, repress. It's to open up.
Yeah.
Open up the dialogue in the way that Make Love Not Porn is working to. Open up to welcoming, supporting, and funding the entrepreneurs who want to disrupt all of this for the better, and open up to allowing us to do business on the same terms and conditions everybody else does. I've been working for the past 1.5 years to raise funding for Make Love Not Porn. My single biggest obstacle is the social dynamic that I call fear of what other people will think.
Yeah.
It is never what the person I'm talking to thinks. Because when you understand what we're doing and why we're doing it, nobody can argue with it. It is always their fear of what they think other people will think, which, by the way, you know, is the single most paralyzing dynamic in business and in life. You will never own the future if you care what other people think.
Yeah.
And I've been particularly disappointed in our industry because I would have loved the ad industry to fund its own.
Yeah.
Make Love Not Porn is the holy grail of our industry. It's a big creative idea that is tackling a huge unaddressed global social need that is doing so in a way that is designed to do an awful lot of good and make an awful lot of money simultaneously. And yet nobody in our industry is brave enough to back us.
Yeah. I was wondering if you, did you also consider some kind of crowdfunding for this? Or is that something that you looked at or will consider?
So fear of what other people will think rules out two of the usual three funding routes for tech startups.
Mm.
First of all, it rules out VCs, venture right. capitalists, institutional investors, too many yeah. stakeholders. But secondly, it also rules out, very depressingly, crowdfunding.
Mm.
And there are two reasons. The second one is a much bigger issue than the first. The first is pretty inhibiting anyway. The first is that crowdfunding platforms, well, Kickstarter is no adult content.
Yeah.
Other crowdfunding platforms are either no adult content or they make an artificial distinction between sex toys, fine, people having sex on video, not fine. But the bigger issue is that successful crowdfunding requires a very large number of people willing to very publicly rally around something and very publicly invite their entire network in to do so as well.
Yeah.
People will totally publicly rally around a piece of hardware, a video game, a movie concept. They will not publicly rally in large numbers around anything to do with sex.
Yeah.
And I can say this with complete confidence because, depressingly, I see the evidence in my social media feed every day.
Mm.
I'm a Twitter and Facebook addict. I tweet and post about a whole range of things: advertising, tech, feminism, business, sex, make love, not porn. My tweets and my posts about sex and make love, not porn are read. They are never liked, shared, and retweeted at the same level as anything else I put out there. I tweet about make love, not porn, and my tweet will get 25,000 impressions and 2 retweets.
Mm.
And I know this not only from my own social media analytics, but also from talking to friends who have said to me, Cindy, you're absolutely right. You know, I love what you're doing. I totally get it. I'm a parent. I read everything you post about make love, not porn. I never retweet it to any of my followers.
Yeah.
That's the problem. And so what that leaves is the third route, which is angel investors,
mm-hmm.
Which is the route we're going down, looking
yeah.
for funding. And our challenge there is that any other startup can at least, on the angel front, do its research and target. So other startups can go, oh, you know, so-and-so has publicly said they want to invest in blah, clean tech, whatever it is. So-and-so has a portfolio of investments, indicates their interests are blah.
Mm.
Nobody currently is putting their hand up going, bring me sex tech.
Yeah.
And sex is the one area where you cannot tell from the outside what anybody thinks on the inside. And so I have a two-pronged approach to finding our kind of investors. I just ask publicly everywhere I go.
Yeah.
I have no pride. I need funding. I need help. I ask for it.
Mm-hmm.
So every public speaking gig, I ask on the stage. Every media interview I do, I ask the journalist to write into, you know, their article the fact we're looking for investors.
Yeah.
And then the second thing I do is whoever I come across, I always ask them who they know personally. Because when you know somebody personally, you know what they're like behind closed doors. You know what they're like when they let their hair down,
yeah.
what they're like when they talk about sex. Those are our key performance indicators for the kind of person who might be open-minded enough to be our kind of investor. And by the way, if anybody listening to this knows any open-minded investors or is an open-minded investor, hit me up, Cindy at makelovenotporn.com.
Absolutely. Brilliant. Okay, so that's a lot of challenges. And it's making me think, and it's a shame that, well, it's a shame. I see that the creative communications industry or creative industry, advertising industry is not supporting this more. But I also had another question that was kind of linked to, but extending it slightly. It's about the fact that in supporting this project, I think one of the fantastic things is, which I agree with, is great, and you talk about as well, is a key to great sex is communication and great communication. And a key to the approach that we have towards sex is communication and education, as you've just been talking about. And I wonder if with all your experience in the experience that you have of the creative industry from the behind the scenes, are there good lessons or examples that can be taken from that, from the world of advertising and branding, that can be applied for everyone to have more communication while they're having sex, or to have great sex altogether?
No, I'm trying to teach the world of advertising and branding about that.
Yeah, okay, so the other way around.
So I want to see more authentic, open, honest, healthy depictions of sex in popular culture generally.
Yeah.
And so I am constantly trying to educate and inspire our industry to do this. Mm. I gave a talk at Cannes several years ago on youth brands and porn, mm-hmm. How the single biggest social cultural influence on young people today that we don't talk about. I'm very pleased to have the support of The Drum, the UK media and communications industry publishing platform. Yep. They interviewed me last year, and all this is Googleable, by the way, on how, you know, brands can partner with Make Love Not Porn, yep, to be able to operate more healthy around sex.
Okay.
PR Week reached out last year and asked me to write an op-ed about the future of sex for our industry. And most recently, Little Black Book Online published just a few weeks ago an in-depth interview with me, which you can find if you Google Cindy Gallup and advertising needs to get over its sex problem.
Yeah.
And I also spoke about this in my 3% 2015 yeah. Conference keynote.
And I'll add all the links on the show notes when it's published.
Yeah,
as
great.
Well.
Yeah. So you know, I am constantly making the point that our industry does consumers a huge disservice when it fails to acknowledge this one universal area of human experience in any way whatsoever. Mm. And, you know, we have a responsibility and we have an opportunity to help change the world through sex as well, that our industry is spectacularly failing to take.
Yeah. I was wondering, and this is very probably stuff that you already know about, but I was talking to a friend of mine for the podcast last week, Anjali, who co-founded Ada's List in the UK, but also expanded to the US. You know about it. And she also works with Angel Academy, which is dedicated to supporting female-founded startups, apparently. I'm sure you have contacts with both of those, right?
I don't with Angel Academy, but I'm delighted to hear it. The depressing thing about the many organizations that are working to fund female-founded startups is that they still have access to very few funds themselves.
Right.
It isn't until we affect genuine mainstream change that you will get women raising the kind of funding rounds that white men can. Mm. You will get women making the huge exits that white men can, and you will get women topping the Silicon Valley billionaires list in the way that only white men do currently. So I enormously applaud all of the efforts of, I have many friends working to turn more women into angel investors, to, you know, try and get more funding for female-founded startups. And the depressing thing is that, you know, those funding amounts are very small at the moment. You know, I'm trying to raise $2 million to fund Make Love Not Porn. Yeah. And, you know, I represent the triple whammy of unfundability. I'm female, I'm older, and I have a sex tech startup.
Yeah. Yes. And of the people that you're talking about in terms of friends or actually around there, do you have any, or are there people that are allies about having this kind of conversation around sex in the world these days? Or is it really kind of pretty lonely right now?
Make Love at Porn has had nothing but a hugely positive response everywhere in the world ever since it launched.
Yeah.
My only barriers are business and funding ones.
Yes, yeah. It's the conversion. Like, people are ready to talk about it and listen, but
oh my God, we could not be more embraced.
Yeah.
And again, as I said, it is not about even the people I'm talking to in business. Mm-hmm. You know, it is their fear of what they think other people will think.
Right.
You know, I've talked to senior people in banks who've said, I completely support what you're doing. Our compliance department won't.
Right.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
And you know, the frustration is all of these problems go away with money, mm-hmm. with funding. The three huge disruption opportunities in tech today are sex, cannabis, and Bitcoin.
Yes.
And ironically, investors are flooding into the other two more than they are the first. And so what that allows cannabis and Bitcoin, VCs and startups to do, is they can afford lobbyists. They can afford to fund regulation change, public education initiatives, foundations. We need all of that in sex tech. Money makes all of these problems go away. It makes all the barriers melt away immediately. If I could just raise the funding we need for Make Love Not Porn, we can scale to have a truly global impact. And it's enormously frustrating in a world where VCs are flinging millions of dollars at utterly trivial iPhone apps and games, that they will not put $2 million into, you know, the case for funding Make Love Not Porn is, I say to investors, what's it worth to have your daughter's first sexual experience be a positive one? What's it worth to have your kids not grow up fucked up?
Yeah.
That's the benefit of investing in us.
Got it. All right. Well, it's definitely a compelling argument. If I had the money right now, I would give some.
Thank you, darling.
What else is going on in the area of sex tech? You wrote a few articles about some other potentially interesting or exciting stuff. Well, the one question that I had was that there's a lot of talk about virtual reality headsets right now. And of course, but there's been a couple of articles about first forays of porn being used in that. But I wonder either virtual reality or other technology or interesting stuff going on in the areas of sex tech.
So, I have been pioneering and championing sex tech as a sector, and the you know, increasing ubiquity of the hashtag sex tech is a direct result of my efforts. And you know, I would urge your listeners to both Google sex tech and search the hashtag on Twitter to see a lot of the coverage of this. The reason I'm doing this is because, as I regularly say to other entrepreneurs, when you have a truly world-changing startup, you have to change the world to fit it, not the other way around.
Yeah.
So I realized very, very early on I was going to have to pave my own way. I have to break down the business barriers in my path in order to scale and grow Make Love Not Porn to be the billion-dollar venture I know it can be. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I do a whole tranche of work that is aimed at demonstrating the tech and business world that the next big thing in tech is disrupting sex. Now, what is frustrating about this is that because we are all so fucked up about sex, a lot of media and tech blog coverage of sex tech defaults to the hardware.
Yeah.
Because it's a lot easier to talk about teledildonics, sex robots, VR, than it is to talk about people actually having sex. And Make Love Not Porn operates on the software side. We are using technology to bring people closer together in the real world, which is something that you know, a lot of other female-founded ventures are. Mm-hmm. And the irony is that the more you focus on the hardware, the more you are focusing on technology designed to drive us further and further apart from each other into virtual worlds, versus the aim of Make Love Not Porn and other software sex tech startups, which is to bring people closer together in the real world, which is what we really need.
Yeah.
So I talk a lot about virtual reality because I'm asked about it all the time. Mm-hmm. And I talk about the fact that all anyone can think about is VR porn, but actually we are enormously interested in virtual reality at Make Love Not Porn because we are interested in the VR potential for real world sex. Mm. And the reason that potential is so huge is because VR is utterly unique as a form of technology. VR enables something that no other form of technology ever has, which is empathy.
Yeah.
VR enables you quite literally for the first time ever to put yourself in somebody else's shoes. And the reason that has enormous applicability in real world sex is, you know, I'll use one example. So several years ago, Charlie Glickman, who is a wonderful sex educator blogger, mm-hmm. he wrote a fabulous blog post called How Pegging Can Help Save the World. And I share this post regularly, and we share it a lot at Make Love Not Porn. For the benefit of those of your audience who do not know what pegging is, it is when a woman uses a strap-on dildo to penetrate a guy.
Okay.
And the reason Charlie wrote a blog post called How Pegging Can Help Save the World is because he makes the point that when a straight guy is pegged, when, as Charlie puts it, you become the catcher, not the hitter, it gives men a completely new perspective and worldview on why, as women, we have to be in the mood to have sex. Mm. When you are the penetratee versus the penetrator, you suddenly realize why you need to be in the right mood. You need to be in the right frame of mind. You need to be warmed up. You need to be able to be utterly receptive before somebody puts something inside you. Mm. So that is the kind of empathy that VR can bring to real world sex. And we are very much looking forward to be able to deploy VR at Make Love Not Porn when we can raise the funding to be able to do so.
Mm. Got it. And talking about real world and intimacy relationships, I have a good friend in Singapore who's really interested and passionate about the topic of sex education as well. And she's recently started a business so she organizes workshops with women to talk about their sexuality, to share about it, to she introduces different types of toys as well and how to use them and have more fun, etc. With sex altogether. So people like that, or anybody who wants to participate. So I understand you're, or at least from what I've seen.
And what's the name of the venture?
Lila Sutra.
Oh, right. I've come across it and I absolutely love it. Tell her to email me. I'd love to talk to her.
Definitely. I'll definitely do that. So I was wondering, though, people like that and other people generally who are interested in either supporting Make Love Not Porn itself, the whole idea of sex education, is there anything they can do on the platform? It might be sharing a video, but can it be something else too? I don't know.
We absolutely want to. I talk a lot in my business speaking about the fact that in every industry currently, what we see is the syndrome that I call collaborative competition.
Yeah.
Collaborative competition is where everybody in a sector competes or else in the sector by doing exactly the same thing everyone else in the sector is doing. Bad idea. And I believe the future instead is competitive collaboration. And what I mean by that is when all of us in the sector come together and collaborate in order to help each other, in a way, by the way, that we don't see currently, on the premise of a rising tide floats all boats. That is what then allows each of us off the top of that wave to then be uniquely competitive using our own individual skills and talents. So I want Make Love Not Porn to collaborate with every single other venture out to change the world through sex. I conceive Make Love Not Porn as ultimately one day to become the foundational platform and hub for an entire collaborative ecosystem of related and relevant brands, products, and services. An example, by the way, of how I'm trying to help this currently is that last year, Fast Company reached out and, you know, asked to write an article about all of the battles that we fight building Make Love Not Porn.
Yeah.
I said, I'm really happy to be interviewed, you know, very happy to talk to you, but I will only do this on condition. Here are six other sex tech startups that I also want you to talk to. I don't care if my column inches go down to this much. You know, what's important to me is that the world understands there's an entire movement of us and we can't be stopped. So, you know, I very much, another thing I want to raise funding for is to be able to build out Make Love Not Porn so that we can embrace and promote everybody, like your friend's venture. You know, we can link to them, you know, people can click through to buy their products and services from our platform. You know, and by the way, the reason I ask your friend to contact me is because I am logging, you know, as many other sex tech startups as I can now, because I absolutely want to be able to collaborate and work together. You know, I would really hope sooner rather than later.
Yes.
And so that is very much part of our vision at Make Love Not Porn. And you know, we very much want to demonstrate to the world that sex tech is this hugely powerful sector. Every other big bet ever made in the history of tech pales against sex tech.
Yeah. Great. I'll get you in touch a bit later today. And I sent her an email yesterday to be on the podcast because I was reminded of her work by reading some of your articles. I was like, oh, I should get back in touch with her.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Excellent. So how about the other side of the other business that you're running, If We Ran the World, which is that's your consultancy business or that's another business entirely? Right.
No, so it's my other startup this is the slightly unfortunate aspect of, of Make Love Not Porn blowing up accidentally the way it did. So If We Ran the World is the startup that I was working on when Make Love Not Porn took off. And I have had, unfortunately, to back burner If We Ran the World, because even I, superhuman as I am, cannot run two startups simultaneously.
Yes.
Where If We Ran the World comes from is, you know, as I said earlier, you know, my belief is that the future of business is doing good and making money simultaneously.
Yeah.
And so I believe the business model of the future is shared values plus shared action equals shared profit. Financial profit and social profit. And what I mean by that is when brands and businesses come together with their consumers, their audiences, on the basis of values that you all share, which, by the way, is the most fundamental requirement for a good relationship in life as much as business. Mm-hmm. You will never truly bond with someone if you don't share the same values. when brands come together with consumers around the basis of shared values, and when brands then enable consumers and the brands themselves to collectively and collaboratively co-act on those values, to walk the talk together, you can then make things happen in the real world that will benefit consumers, benefit society, and benefit the brand and its business. So if We Ran the World is co-action software that is designed to help brands inculcate that business model and integrate it into the way they do business on a daily basis, unfortunately, as I say, I was working on If We Ran the World when Make Love Not Porn blew up, but I designed MakeLoveNotPorn.tv around precisely that business model, shared values plus shared action equals shared profit. And, you know, again, one of the reasons I'm raising funding for Make Love Not Porn, or trying to, is in order to be able to hire a full-time team to run Make Love Not Porn. And when I can do that, I want to reactivate If We Ran the World.
Yes.
And I guess, the one good thing about having had to back burner If We Ran the World for the past few years while I focused on Make Love Not Porn is that in the meantime, the world and our industry has caught up with that concept. Because, you know, If We Ran the World was ahead of its time when we introduced it. Mm-hmm. It's about doing good and making money, not in the old world order way that a lot of brands currently do it, which goes, we make money here, and then we do good by writing checks to causes to clear our conscience over here. But about, you know, we make money because we do good.
Yes.
We find a way to integrate social responsibility into the way we do business on a day-to-day basis that therefore makes it a key driver of our future growth and profitability.
Yeah.
Because I want to see a world where the way it works is the more money we make, the more good we do, the more good we do, the more money we make. And so, you know, what I really appreciate is that increasingly people have been reaching out to me about If Around the World. They've come across it. I mean, what was really flattering was, when If Around the World was 12 months old in beta, Harvard Business School reached out to me and said, you know, this is such an innovative business model. We want to write this up and teach it as a case study, which was enormously flattering. And so I had the very surreal experience at only 12 months old in beta of, you know, going to Harvard, watching a professor teach If Around the World as a case study, and it is now available as a Harvard Business School case study, accessible to students around the world. And so people reach out, people increasingly get what If Around the World is all about. And so I am very keen, to be able to find the brands to partner with where we can showcase this business model and create very compelling case studies that will encourage more and more businesses to take it on.
Yeah. That's definitely very, very exciting. I can say better anything that you're saying, and totally agree with the shared value side of things. Absolutely. Doing good and making money at the same time and integrating everything together without anything or anyone left out.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. There's been a lot of talk, and your apartment is quite famous as well. It's been featured in a bunch of magazines, and it's in a music video, Notorious B.I.G. There was one video that I saw where you're in your apartment, and I believe it was your apartment anyway, because it's black. So I think it was, but you have an amazing, apparently, book collection that I was kind of salivating at, that looks really, really brilliant. Books all over the place that sounded really exciting. It's not even a question. I'm just saying that.
Right. Well, I should just say, so that is my old apartment.
Okay.
And for anybody listening, if you Google the black apartment, you will see it. And yes, I'm a voracious reader, and I cannot ever bear to throw away or give away books. And so I have a huge library. But I sold the black apartment last fall.
Mm.
And so I am now, I'm now in my new apartment. But I'm in my new apartment pre-renovation, because it needs to be gut renovated, and then it will be as spectacular as black apartment, but in a completely different way. It's called the Sky Apartment. And it's going to take a while. I literally have only just moved in last month. I'm living in the before picture currently. But in early 2017, I will be able to unveil the Sky Apartment. And I think people will very much enjoy seeing what that looks like.
Wow, that sounds exciting. It's an exciting creative project going on.
It is exciting, yeah.
Brilliant. Okay. What else is happening with you? Are you planned to talk anywhere that people can go and listen
to?
Or,
Sure. So because both my startups are very early stage and pay me nothing, I support myself through paid consultancy and paid public speaking.
Yeah.
Depending on how global your listeners are, I will next be talking, I'm speaking at invitation only events, so those aren't open to the public, but I guess my next public speaking will be, I'm speaking in Sydney, Australia in early June. I'm speaking at Mumbrella 360, which is the annual conference for the ad industry held by Mumbrella, the Australasian media platform for the industry. I'm the opening keynote speaker. I'll be talking about the importance of diversity in our industry, and I'll also be doing a panel and a round table on that in the course of Mumbrella. So anybody who can, come to see me speak in Sydney, June 7th to 9th. Then I'll be speaking, I'm trying to think, what else is public. I'm speaking that I know of because I get booked all the time, but I'll be speaking at, UX, User Experience Week in San Francisco in August. Again, that's entirely open to the public. So anyone come and see me speak there. I will be speaking at an advertising conference in Ecuador in the fall. I think we're still confirming the dates there. And if people follow me on Twitter at Cindy Gallup or follow my Facebook page or follow me on LinkedIn, I publish the details of where I'm speaking so that people can get a sense there.
And I'll add the links of all the different conferences we just talked about.
Terrific.
So I usually finish with just a couple of kind of cool down questions I call. So it's the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. So somehow I include an ice cream question in there.
Excellent. I adore ice cream.
Brilliant. Favorite flavor?
That's a tough one because I have many. I'm a huge fan of Ben & Jerry's. And I'm a huge fan of Ben & Jerry's because I am of the school that likes a small amount of ice cream with my bits. So I'm all about the stuff in the ice cream. And I have to say that I'm a huge fan of Ben & Jerry's cinnamon roll ice cream. Mm. I also actually love Haagen-Dazs rum and raisin as well. I love the Ben & Jerry's frozen Greek yogurt flavors. I adore their core flavors where they have like,
the cookie or caramel.
So, you know, it's very tough for me to pick out just one flavor. I'd say anything that Ben & Jerry's make involving lots of bits and a nice swirly bit in the middle, I'm all for.
Yeah. I have the same kind of issues with choosing flavors as well. Definitely. So this is a cheeky one. Do you have opinions about using ice cream in playing and foreplay?
I think ice cream is a very sensual food anyway.
Yeah.
I think you have to really watch it with anything that's cold
or hot. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I mean, obviously, you know, I was working at BBH London when we did our famous Haagen-Dazs campaign of like back in the 90s that really set the agenda for sensual food campaigns and sensual ice cream campaigns subsequently.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was fabulous. I think ice cream is a lovely central thing to eat together. It does make things very sticky. I'll be perfectly honest. I'm not a huge fan of you know, using it all over yourself, but I can see that some people might be.
Yeah, got it. And another big topic for the podcast, which is a big interest of mine, is games and role playing games in particular. And so my kind are generally fantasy, you know, playing elves and orcs and that kind of stuff in Dungeons and Dragons settings. But of course, when I talk about it with people, people often imagine the more sexual essential kind of role playing games. And, there's one thing I was wondering if you've come across anything or anyone doing interesting kind of educational play in games around sexual role playing games, either in, I don't know, the sex therapist or a sex tech enterprise or anything of the kind, because I was wondering, like, it's usually great communication is important sex, that it's not easy sometimes, and I was wondering if anybody was using this kind of approach to ease things in, or do you see what I mean?
No, absolutely. So obviously, you know, that is part of what we showcase on Make Love Not Porn. So we absolutely have our Make Love Not Porn stars. You know, they video themselves, you know, playing those sorts of games, you know, role playing, whatever. And, you know, again, our community tells us that, you know, we are not, makelovenotporn.tv is not something you just watch. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's why I also say very emphatically we're not porn, because porn is purely masturbation material.
Yeah.
We are not simply that. We're that too, by the way, very happy to be that. But we are so many more things. So we are an engagement and a communications vehicle. And so, you know, individuals and couples tell us they get all sorts of ideas from our videos. They feel enormously reassured because obviously we celebrate real world everything, real world bodies, real world penis size, real world breast size. We're inspiring and moving because our videos showcase real world emotions, real world love, real world feelings, real world intimacy. I mean, you know, people write to us and I Make Love Not Porn Stars and say things like, the sex in that video was incidental. I want what you guys have. Yeah. I saw the way you looked at each other. You know, I saw the way you looked into each other's eyes. I want to meet somebody and have that with them. So, you know, we, our videos act as inspiration, communication, prompts, ideas, you know, and stimulus in exactly the way you're talking about.
Yeah. Fantastic. All right. And you often finish your talks with your favorite quote, and I can't think of a better way to end it. So
jolly good. Well, yeah, my favorite quote of all time is Alan Kay, who said, in order to predict the future, you have to invent it.
Yeah.
I am all about inventing the future. Too many people think the future is something that happens without them. It just rolls us all over in its wake. And I'm all about decide what you want the future to be and make it happen. And yeah. Every one of us has the power to do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that was brilliant. And so, yeah, for anybody listening, go and check out Make Love Not Porn and then create your future, whatever that might be.
Terrific. Thanks very much, Willem.
Thank you very much. It was a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Take care. Bye. Okay, bye.
All right. Another episode already finishing. Thank you so much for listening. I really, really appreciate your time. Just for every episode, it's about the same shtick. I mean, it's the same deal. I know it really takes a lot of time. And generally speaking, I had this conversation with a friend a few weeks ago about my newsletter and my podcast, and it is demanding. Like, I'm addressing to people who are willing to spend an hour, willing to spend 10 minutes reading my newsletter, willing to spend a whole time listening to this. I really enjoy making it. I enjoy listening to similar interviews that last for a long time, kind of long form, long demand content. And I really hope you enjoy it. If you have any feedback, please tell me. You can send me an email via the website. That's Willem, W-I-L-L-E-M, at icecreamforeveryone.net. Everything's spelled out. You can contact me on Twitter. I'm at HippoWill. You can post a comment on the Facebook page, icecreamforeveryone.net, or just look for Ice Cream for Everyone on Facebook. And again, if you enjoyed it, just share it with a friend. I mean, essentially, it's only going to go through word of mouth. I'm not really paying for any kind of advertising. So if you enjoy it, just tell a friend about it or post it on your Twitter, on your Facebook, whatever it is. That'd be awesome. I think that's about it for now. Thank you so much and see you next time. Bye-bye.